A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 14, Triumph and Nemesis.
One major factor in the decline of Sparta, contributing to that decline, and one major factor contributing as well, and by no means insignificantly, to the catastrophic Spartan defeat at Leuctra, was what the Greeks called oliganthropia, the fewness of men, or the long-term decline in Spartan citizen numbers by 85% or so. And people have speculated a good deal as to what brought that about, all the more so because the Spartans themselves were profoundly interested in keeping their citizen numbers up and valorized childbearing on the part of Spartan women as deeply and thoroughly as any culture I've ever heard of. How then did they fail so miserably? Well, one answer is the big Spartan earthquake of 464, which certainly made off with a large number of Spartan citizens. One is the warlike propensities of the Spartans, although ordinarily up to Leuctra, when the Spartans fought, they won, and in traditional hoplite battles, the winning side did not suffer many casualties, and the Spartans indeed fewer than most, by and large. No one that I know of has come up with a fully persuasive explanation of this phenomenon, and in thinking about it myself, something occurred to me that I don't know, I have not read, I presumably someone else has thought of it, but if so, I haven't heard of it. And that is, it seems to me that one of the difficulties, surely, was the requirement for full Spartan citizenship, that one have the financial resources to make the necessary contribution to the Spartan mess to which one belonged. Originally, so we are told, land had been allocated into various kleroi, various allotments farmed by helots, which provided each Spartan citizen with the requisite grain, olive oil, and so forth, to make the contribution to the mess. But as time went on, fewer and fewer potential Spartans, if we think of them that way, were able to meet that financial criterion. And I think one of the reasons why is this. Land in Sparta for Spartan citizens was effectively the only source of wealth. Spartan citizens were prohibited by law from engaging in any form of trade, handicraft, or anything like that. And it was those sources of wealth elsewhere in the Greek world and elsewhere in later centuries within the world of landed wealth which contributed to maintaining a relatively large aristocracy. That avenue in Sparta was blocked off, and as families died out, holdings concentrated in fewer and fewer families, and there was no way for anyone outside the original land-holding families to generate the wealth sufficient to buy land and to enter the aristocracy. I would suspect that, though by no stretch of the imagination, the only factor or anything close to it may have been a contributing factor as well. In any case, the number of Spartans declined significantly, and after Leuctra, when the Spartan Manpool had taken yet another major hit. Epaminondas led 30,000 to 40,000 allied troops and invaded Laconia itself, the first time that had happened in many, many centuries. Absolutely unprecedented. Sparta was an unwalled city, as they proudly said. Its walls were its citizens. Laconia had not been invaded by Athens by anybody else, essentially, ever since the Dorians had come at this point, something on the order of 700 years before. And the sight of Laconian fields on fire at the hands of Epaminondas' marauders was shocking. What he did next was even more damaging to Sparta. He went over, basically, the divide between Sparta and Messenia and liberated the Messenian Helots, who had been a major, if not the major, source of Sparta's wealth for centuries. Sparta never regained control of Messenia again. And he founded at Ithome, which had been the citadel in the Messenian revolt of the mid-5th century, a new city called Messina as a capital for the now freed Messenians. And the next year, he went beyond that to consolidate a group of cities in Arcadia, north of Laconia, and centered them on another new city, Megalopolis, big city. So not only did he defeat Sparta in battle, he freed the Helots, many of the Helots, and removed the wherewithal upon which Spartan power was based. Shortly afterward, unsurprisingly, the Peloponnesian League, which Sparta had headed for a century and a good deal longer, in fact, just dissolved. And Sparta stood alone, without Messenia, just Laconia, a very, very much diminished polity. Epaminondas himself died in 362 at yet another battle of Mantinea, but by that time, from a Spartan perspective, the damage was very much done. And here is Epaminondas' epitaph in Thebes, which suggests what folks at the time, at least in Thebes, thought of his accomplishments. "This came from my counsel. Sparta has cut the hair of its glory." Spartan warriors, you remember, traditionally wore their hair very long indeed. Well, they don't do that anymore, so to speak. They've been cut back severely. "Messina takes her children in. A wreath of the spears of Thebes has crowned Megalopolis. Greece is free." King Agesilaus, whose misfortune it was to preside over the process of Spartan decline, to some degree as a result of his own choices and own actions, died in 360, an old man reduced in his 80s to serving as a mercenary in Egypt. The Egyptians were very impressed with his reputation. When they saw him physically, they were a good deal less impressed. But it's revealing that the one-time most powerful man in Greece and the humbler of Lysander wound up himself in what for the time was deep old age, selling his military expertise to try to keep Sparta going. What happened in the next generation? Sparta, much diminished, maintaining its independence, was the final decline of Thebes, and indeed, ultimately, the destruction of the independent Greek city-state at the hands of Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, who at the Battle of Chaeronea in 338 crushed a Greek coalition against him, which did not include Sparta, by the way, and came to dominate Thebes, Athens, and others in the so-called League of Corinth, a pretty name for Macedonian hegemony, which was at least purportedly devoted to finally settling the score with Persia once and for all with a pan-Hellenic invasion. Leading the Macedonian cavalry at the Battle of Chaeronea was Philip's 18-year-old son, Alexander, and 2 years later, after Philip was assassinated at a wedding procession, Alexander took the throne and also took over his father's project of invading Persia. Philip had deliberately excluded Sparta from the Corinthian League, dominated by Macedon, with a view towards assuring that feelings against Sparta still running high, Sparta would be causing no problem to Macedonia in his absence or at any other time. And by and large, that strategy worked. Well, the Spartans accordingly played no part in the subsequent career of Alexander III of Macedon, better known as Alexander the Great, who astonishingly succeeded in what had been a Gisela's goal and what had been a sort of wish fulfillment dream for generations of Greeks, and that was not just holding Persia at bay, but overcoming Persia. After his first major victory at the Battle of the Granicus River against Persia, Alexander sent to the Spartans, or made sure that the Spartans were aware of the following scornful message. When he sent back to Athens 300 panoplies, suits of hoplite armor, with this inscription: Alexander, son of Philip, and the Greeks, except the Spartans, no Spartans involved in this, dedicated these spoils from the barbarians of Asia. To send those to Athens, deliberately to exclude the Spartans, and, as has been pointed out, to send precisely 300 was in all kinds of ways a pointed gesture. You will remember that Sparta's finest hour, in Sparta's first engagement in the wars between Greeks and Persians, was the 300 Spartans who died with Leonidas at Thermopylae. Finally, in Alexander's mind at least, the Greeks are turning the tide, but in this triumphant beginning of the Greek invasion of Persia rather than the Persian invasion of Greece, the Spartans have no part. And it clearly seemed worthwhile to Alexander to make sure that the rest of Greece recognized that the Spartans had no part. An instance of something not far from deliberate humiliation. In 331, after Alexander's decisive battle against the Persian Empire at Gaugamela, or Arbela, in Mesopotamia, when he crushed the forces of Darius III once and effectively for all, the Spartans, meanwhile, were attempting to rebel against Macedonian hegemony and were defeated same year at Megalopolis, city founded by Epaminondas in what Alexander scornfully referred to in contrast to his own glorious conquest as, quote unquote, the Battle of Mice. Macedonian policy was clearly not only to keep Sparta diminished and unimportant, but to the degree possible, to keep Sparta well aware of its own humiliation. After the death of Alexander, as Alexander's generals fought among themselves to carve up his extensive conquests, Sparta remained untaken and vestigially, in some sense, independent, standing apart to some degree from the rest of Greece, by no means as important as it once was, suffering periodic defeats at the hands of Macedonian and others, but still, in one sense or another, standing on its own 2 feet. There was one last burst of at least an attempt to regain the luster of Spartan institutions and power nearly a century after Alexander, on the part of among the last two Spartan kings. Plutarch, interestingly, chose these two kings, who were not brothers, but who advanced in some sense similar agendas and were brother kings, if not literal brothers, as the counterpart in his paired lives to the Gracchi, the high Roman aristocrats who had been, in effect, populists before the event and were assassinated for their pains in the Rome of the 2nd century BCE, the 100s, at least arguably initiating the century or so of warfare that finally led to the rise of the Roman Empire under the leadership of Augustus. One of them was a person by the name of Agis IV, who ascended the throne in 244. Women, as you will recall, in Sparta had long, if not always, been able to inherit property. And indeed, according to Plutarch, the two richest people in Sparta, not just women, but people in Sparta, were the mother and grandmother of King Agis, not King Agis himself, but his mother and grandmother, who had the name of Agisistrata, his mother, and Archidamia, his grandmother. They, And also, Agis's wife, Agiatis, in conjunction with Agis himself, conceived the notion that Sparta might be regenerated if the richest citizens, among them, of course, the members of his own family, would voluntarily give over their wealth to the Spartan state and allow that wealth, landed wealth, to be redistributed on the lines of the original purportedly Lycurgan program into a series of kleroi, land reform, essentially. And his wife and his mother and his grandmother and he himself, among the absolutely wealthiest people in Sparta, were powerfully in favor of this program, which they thought would enhance, obviously, the number of citizens in Sparta, and coupled with a reintroduction of something resembling the old Lycurgan lifestyle, the agoge and so forth, would make of Sparta the kind of power it once had been. As it happened, other wealthy Spartans did not feel this way, and Agis was assassinated. Shortly thereafter, though, in 235 or 236, effectively the last of the Agaid kings, Cleomenes III, ascended, married to the woman who had previously been the wife of the assassinated Agis IV, Agiatis, and the son of yet another very wealthy and effectively very radical Spartan female aristocrat named Critisoclea. Supposedly, in large part at the instigation of his wife, Agiatis, Cleomenes carried further and effectively carried out the reforms which King Agis IV had proposed. And learning a lesson from his predecessor, he had the ephors killed, radically devalued the importance of the gerousia, in other words, getting rid of the traditional Spartan checks to royal power so that he could carry out his own political, social, economic, and military program of regeneration, and indeed had his own brother appointed to the Eurypontid throne, the other Spartan throne, effectively uniting in one family and under his personal control the traditional Spartan kingship. For a while, not for very long, but for a while, all of these measures proved very successful for Cleomenes, and he at least briefly was able to dominate pretty nearly the whole of the Peloponnese. And for a moment, reconstitute, if not the power of Sparta in her quasi-imperial days, the power of Sparta as she once had been as the dominant force, at least, in the Peloponnese. But politics in the Greek world were always complicated. He, too, was maneuvered out of his position of dominance, and in 222, lost catastrophically at the Battle of Salacia to Antigonus III of Macedon, and for the first time ever, Sparta was actually occupied by a hostile power. He and his mother went off to exile in Egypt, where he died 3 years later, and Sparta continued its decline. A last hurrah of sorts came under the leadership of the so-called tyrant Nabis, who ruled from 207 to 192, but in the meantime, the Romans were beginning to become dominant over Macedon and ultimately dominant over Greece. And by 146, essentially all of Greece was effectively a Roman protectorate. Interestingly enough, though Sparta never regained her independent power, Sparta, in another sense, in a diminished sense, did quite well under Roman rule. It did nothing to hurt Sparta that in 40 BCE, Livia, the wife of Augustus, was given asylum during the civil wars in Sparta, and it also did nothing to hurt Sparta that when push came to shove in the final battles of the Roman civil wars, Sparta was fortunate enough to side with Octavian over Antony, something which Octavian never forgot. But the Sparta of later times was not much like the Sparta of earlier times in terms of power. What it became under Roman domination, and this is distressing, unsettling, ironic, is something not unlike a historical theme park and a focus for tourism. Both Plutarch and Pausanias, writing about and just after the turn of the first century Common Era, visited Sparta, and they described a Sparta where the agoge was still maintained and Lycurgan norms were still maintained, and indeed the diamastigosis, the beating of the boys at the Temple of Artemis Orthia, was a big tourist attraction in itself. But Sparta had become, by that point, something not unlike an ongoing historical shrine to its own past, particularly to its past in the time of the Persian Wars, and was a sight on the late imperial aristocratic grand tour, and kind of a major one. A place that, to me at least, this is perhaps an unpleasant thing to say, has kind of the same effect, is the city of Venice, the traditional city of Venice, which was a real financial and naval power for a millennium, more or less. If you visit it now, the central historical canal-laden, gondola-filled core is something like a real-life, living history, colonial Williamsburg-style theme park to the glorious past of Venice. And that, at last, in classical times, is what Sparta seems to have turned into, an ongoing living monument to itself. Well, a long, mixed, and rich history, but though there is much for us to reject and excoriate in the culture of Sparta as it's revealed over the course of its thousand-odd-year existence as a culturally more or less independent entity, and for the most part as a politically independent entity, it leaves us with many things to admire as well. And perhaps it might not be inappropriate to include this series of lectures with the most famous apothegm or quip of them all from the mouth of a Spartan mother to her son going into battle, which is, with your shield or on it, meaning fight effectively, fight with a view towards protecting your fellows and living up to our ideals, or come back on your shield as a corpse. In other words, don't come back at all. Fidelity unto death. That's a high standard, and that, at their best, was what the Spartans really and truly did embody. Thank you very much.
This ends Lecture 14. Now that you've completed this course, be sure to test your comprehension by taking the final exam. You'll find the exam on this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com. Once there, you can access this course by using the password 1134TBS. Again, that's 1134TBS. If you enjoyed this program, the Modern Scholar series from Recorded Books offers courses in a variety of subject areas taught by the world's greatest professors. Call 1-800-636-3399 or visit the course's webpage for a free catalog. This course, produced by John J. Alexander, is copyrighted 2007 by Recorded Books, LLC. The lecture text is copyrighted 2007 by Timothy Schutt. The lectures were edited under the direction of Ian McCullough.